kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar, and we are embarking on yet another Film Spotting marathon. This time, we're taking a look at six films from Vincent Minnelli. It's been a while since we have explored classic Hollywood cinema. Actually, it's not really coming to mind the last time we did anything.
What are you guys, snobs?
Hollywood.
You're
snobs.
We are.
Would it be, I don't even know if this would count, really, Ophuls? I mean, is it that long ago that we
probably
did something
so. We
from
are
this
usually
era?
Doing Bergman or something like that, or Kieslowski. Michael, do you have a problem with that?
No.
Varda,
what
do you have against Agnes Varda?
Yeah,
I'm
Michael,
no snob in that direction. I resent the implication. Let's just get to the
marathon. Let's get to Minnelli.
Get to the marathon. He was, in fact, born in Chicago, so we
yes,
should probably
was.
Get to him.
Okay. Michael Phillips from the Chicago Tribune is here, the professor. He's going to be playing the role of professor here to shepherd us through this Minnelli marathon, because you've been waiting for this for a long time. You have been urging us to do this marathon, fill in some of these blind spots. Minnelli is a favorite of yours.
Yes, he is. He really is. And you know, you mentioned Ophuls, and he's a visual stylist that Minnelli, I think, consciously and unconsciously, learned an awful lot from, and he's just one of my favorites. I can't wait to talk about him.
Okay, well, we're going to hear some sounds of Cabin in the Sky from 1943, the first movie in our Minnelli marathon here in a moment, but we do want to take a moment to welcome back our presenting sponsor of this marathon. Happy to have Mubi back on board as that sponsor. Cult, classic, and independent films from around the world. Josh, no algorithm has ever cried during a tearjerker or laughed at a comedy or boldly defended a film till it was blue in the face.
I've never seen it.
No. Which is why an algorithm has no business choosing your films. Mubi is a curated online cinema streaming exceptional films from around the globe. Each day, they introduce a new gem, and you have 1 month to watch it. Whether it's a timeless classic, a festival darling, or an acclaimed masterpiece, each film is hand-selected by experts like Michael Phillips. They need to get Michael Phillips involved. You could be the expert to help them.
Yes. Well,
you know,
actually, interesting, Adam, based on your recommendations just then, I think you would enjoy Police Academy 6, Mission
you know
to
me.
Moscow.
You know me so well. You can also delve deeper into the films with exclusive interviews, video essays, and critical reviews on Mubi's notebook. So our listeners can try Mubi free for 30 days. Mubi.com, that's MUBI.com/filmspotting, Mubi.com/filmspotting. Josh, what are some current programming highlights that our listeners can check out over at Mubi?
These are highlights for me because I have not seen either of these. Ooh. To my shame.
I've seen both of them. So
oh, look
I'm
at
better
you.
Than you. I'm better than you.
You're Mr. Mubi.
Yeah.
As a lead up to the Oscars, they are showing Damien Chazelle's and Barry Jenkins's debut film. So, Michael, I know you are a huge fan of Damien Chazelle's Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench from 2009. Was it on your top 10 that year?
It was. And that was a really great surprise to catch that. Yeah, no, I'm thrilled. I'm thrilled that they're offering that.
And Desiree Garcia, who's been on this show before, speaking of Chazelle, because we talked about La La Land with her. She's a professor. I know you spoke to her a little bit in preparation for this Minnelli conversation, and she's Madeline.
Yep, she's the co-star of Guy Madeline. Yeah, no, it's great. It's great to see. It's great to see what I think is already a pretty significant American director, Damien Chazelle, right out of the gate, trying everything under the sun and pulling off about 85% of it. So you know, it's really worth seeing.
Mubi also has, as I mentioned, Jenkins' debut that is from 2008, called Medicine for Melancholy, a yearning portrait of modern blackness in San Francisco and a complex romance for a very 21st century city. Adam, as you know, the guy who's seen that. Is that an accurate description?
It is an accurate description. Black and white, it's a smaller film, certainly. It feels like a debut film, much in the way Guy and Madeline does, compared to some of the bigger projects those filmmakers have tackled since, but certainly emblematic of Jenkins' work and worth seeing,
yeah.
I would say.
Yeah, it sort of got echoes of the Linklater Before Sunrise, you know, trilogy.
It does.
And it's like that sort of conversationally driven thing. But it's really sharp. And you can tell there, just like with the Chazelle film, that he's going places.
Yep. Again, that's Mubi.com/filmspotting for your 30-day trial if you want to check out some of those films and more. Let's get to a little bit of Minnelli fun.
And that is why my heart is flying high, mister, 'cause I know we'll have a cabin in the sky.
There may be a cabin in the sky, lady,
That's Eddie Rochester Anderson and Ethel Waters in Vincent Minnelli's Cabin in the Sky. It is from 1943. It is Minnelli's debut film, and it's the debut film in our Minnelli Marathon. And Michael, we really wanted to have you on here to kind of set the table for us, not only for the entire marathon, but for this film and our conversation about it. But first, we always like to ask our guest experts how they started on the journey to becoming experts on a certain genre or filmmaker in this case. When did you first discover and fall in love with Minnelli's work?
I mean, more fan than expert, honestly, because I don't think I know half as much as plenty of the Minnelli scholars out there. Especially, there's a fantastic book by Stephen Harvey, the late Stephen Harvey, that's just called Directed by Vincent Minnelli, that you should seek out if you're at all interested in some of the work you might be seeing in the marathon. But, you know, I honestly have to give it up for public television. When I was 12 years old, there was a series that aired on public TV all across the country called The Men Who Made the Movies. Richard Schickel, the Time magazine critic, put it together, produced it, and wrote the segments. They were just hour-long segments. In the early 70s, an awful lot, old Hollywood directors were still around and sentient and up for an interview. And Schickel put together programs built around the work of Hitchcock, George Cukor, Howard Hawks, all kinds of folks, and Vincent Minnelli. Now, when I was 12, I didn't know that name. I didn't know the name Vincent Minnelli. But I was crazy about movies already, and I saw this hour of interview footage with Minnelli and an awful lot of film footage and selections from the musicals and Minnelli's melodramas and a couple of the comedies. But I just, half hour in, I thought, this is my guy. I knew I loved a certain kind of musical, and Minnelli turned out to have made a couple of them that I had seen. But just to see what, without any kind of conscious sense of what a camera really did and what a director can and should or maybe shouldn't do with a camera when filming a musical number or just a simple dramatic scene, at the end of that hour, I just felt like I had learned an incredible amount about somebody I was kind of already in love with, the stylist of the camera. And he brought such kind of huge, larger-than-life flair to all this different material. And, I mean, they showed clips from The Clock, which is a really interesting melodrama with Judy Garland and Robert Walker, which is, you know, if you had to add one or two to the marathon of six you have going here, The Clock would be one of them for sure. I just thought Minnelli had my kind of style, and then figuring out what that really was and how he achieved it, you know, that's the thing I've been trying to do my whole life since.
So I know this is going to be very difficult for you, Michael, but
Yes. Talk
to us like we're clueless.
Yes.
Pretend we know nothing about cinema.
Okay.
We certainly pretend that we don't know anything about Minnelli. In this case, I've seen two Minnelli films coming in to Cabin in the Sky, The Bad and the Beautiful, which is part of our marathon.
Right.
Because Josh hasn't seen it, and An American in Paris, which we have both seen, and that's why it's not part of the marathon. It was actually part of an early film spotting marathon, musicals, that Sam and I did. So with that minimal background, give us and give our listeners, who might be equally or even more clueless, some things to look out for as we fall in love, hopefully, with Minnelli's style.
I think with Minnelli's career, you can start figuring out what Minnelli movies might mean something to you as an individual, or if he's really your kind of director, just by simply doing what we do when we're younger, or really what we do kind of at the core of all our movie-going interests, which is follow the people on the screen. You know, if you like Fred Astaire, you can certainly check out a couple of Fred Astaire movies. One is the strangest film he ever made and the biggest flop, one of the biggest flops Minnelli ever made, Yolanda and the Thief, which is a complete train wreck of this nutball fantasy, but it has one or two amazing numbers in it, you know. And there's a lot in Minnelli's career where you can say that sentence over and over. You know, a musical or a musical review, in the case of Ziegfeld Follies, which was made just not that long after Cabin in the Sky, that, you know, two-thirds of it is, maybe half of it, is kind of junk and dreck. But there's a number, you know, there's, among other things, there's a dance number. It's the only time Astaire and Kelly danced together in their heyday. That's just fantastic. And, you know, and then, okay, you watch it. You watch it for the talent. And then you start to look at what Minnelli's doing with all the stuff that goes into the definition of mise-en-scene, right? What's up with that specific color blue in the sky. You know, why is the camera able to do that kind of mobile interaction with the dancers? You know, what taught Minnelli exactly when to kind of fling this boom, this crane, way up and get the group shot, and then down without a cut to get to pick up a stare, maybe in Lucille Bremer, you know, his dance partner, and Yolanda and Ziegfeld Follies, you know, and pick that up without cutting. A lot of it. It's just the satisfaction that I appreciate more and more now, all these years into my movie-going life, of just watching what a real highly trained master can do with a moving camera, and how Minnelli can take something like a James Jones novel, which was terrible, apparently. I've never read it. Some Came Running, and turn it into this potent, first-rate melodrama with strange kind of lacings of comedy in it. With this is the one with Frank Sinatra, Shirley MacLaine, Dean Martin, and he's taking the same kind of visual approach to a melodrama, but keeping everything in very kind of enclosed spaces until you get like a fairground sequence. It's all shot in central Indiana too, so it's location work. In addition to that, you have lighting and sort of a scenic design that really feels like it's still got one foot in backlot Hollywood. So you don't really know if it's real or if it's fantasy. And that's Minnelli in a nutshell. Hmm. You're always kind of toggling between an idealized dream world and sort of the bittersweet real world, right? And that's there's two key dichotomies in his work, right? That's one of them. The other one is so many of his stories, whether they're set in modern day or period, or if it's a musical or a melodrama or a comedy, are about a kind of a very basic tension between the challenges and difficulties of romantic life and a private life versus the challenges and difficulties and then the solace of pouring yourself into your work. So it's all it's all this kind of work-life balance stuff, which my wife, columnist Heidi Stevens, who writes the work-life balance column, Balancing Act for the Tribune, would probably enjoy Minnelli, yeah, for this reason. But you know, that's the thing. I think about musicals, and this is where we can get into Cabin in the Sky. That Schickel PBS series also excerpted exactly the right two or three numbers from Cabin in the Sky to get me hooked and make me wonder, what is this? You know, I knew something about what an all-black musical was, and you know what, there's not that many of them in the late 20s, 30s, and 40s, just a handful. But this one looked different and a little better than the stuff I had seen before, and a little less racially egregious and patronizing and humiliating in terms of the stereotypes. It's all there under the surface, and for a lot of people, It's too much present and too uncomfortable to watch in 2018 anyway. But that's something I want to talk about with you guys. But that what I saw in Cabin in the Sky was amazing talent being given a rare opportunity to do what they could in front of a camera. And still, you have to kind of reconcile that with the discomfort a lot of the material causes people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And for me, the talent absolutely wins out when you're watching Cabin in the Sky. I think that the cast there were two hurdles here, right? There is that those elements that still register today, I think you can say, is blatantly racist, that these performers are asked to enact in this storyline. But there's also this sense of, I guess it's almost condescending paternalism. There's that title at the very beginning saying something about how we made this movie to respect other cultures or to explore other cultures. And you get the sense that in 43, you know, this probably was considered by the people who made it a progressive act of diversity, right? But at the same time, that lends a sort of paternalism that the cast has to overcome in addition to the racism that's part of the story and part of the characterizations. And man, once you give Ethel Waters the microphone and she grabs a hold of this story and does what she wants with this character she's been given and mostly gets to move and sing, she leaps a lot of that for me. I mean, this was really my first encounter with her as a performer on screen, and I was just astounded.
She's so great.
Yeah, you know? Michael, why don't you set up a little bit more specifically the plot here. What is the story of Cabin in the Sky?
Minnelli, I'll go back two years earlier. So Minnelli was a big Broadway director at the time and had started in Chicago. He worked 10 years in Chicago earlier as first a costume designer, then a scenic designer, and that's how he developed his visual eye. And before that, he was a window dresser at Marshall Field's. So that's where he first learned how to create images and scenery for a proscenium stage, right? Perfect training.
It's a frame, essentially.
Perfect training. And he was an artist before that. So by the time he's a big Broadway director, he gets a call from MGM. Come on out. Why don't you learn the trade? Okay, so for 2 years, Minnelli just sort of, is a rolling kind of like idea man for hire, helping out on this project, that project, but no real responsibilities. Then he goes to New York, and on a shopping trip, the MGM folks said, hey, there's this all-black musical, Cabin in the Sky. It's got great talent in it. It's a medium hit. Actually, it wasn't that big a hit, but Ethel Waters was in it, and Rex Ingram, who in the film as well plays the devil, right? So two of the big Broadway stars of Cabin in the Sky made the jump to the movie. But they thought, okay, this is a good vehicle for Minnelli's first directorial effort. It's a musical. It's perfect for our new hire, Minnelli. He's our new contract director. So that's where it starts. And it's a very old, even at the time, it was a quaint and kind of cloying old school, quote, Negro folktale, unquote. And in the story, you have Ethel Waters playing Petunia, the wife of Little Joe, played by Eddie Rochester Anderson, Jack Benny's old sidekick. This is in the movie. And he's, this is where it's very uncomfortable to even discuss how you have to describe the character. He's a shiftless no-account, as they keep calling him. He's prone to dice games and gambling. And at the beginning of the story, he is shot and mortally wounded because of a gambling argument. And then in this delirium, right, he's visited in a fever dream by the Lord and the devil, right? And they're going to fight for his soul. So it's a Faustian, it's fighting for his soul, right? And so he's got 6 months to do the right thing. And both the devil and the Lord, who appear, as persona in this little folktale, try to win the battle for his soul, right? And the devil throws him all kinds of temptations, primarily Sweet Georgia Brown, played in the movie by Lena Horne, right? So, and an unbelievable talent, I'd say, Josh. Just like Ethel Waters, you just sort of relax into the unbelievable talent of this musical performer, right? And that's at its best, Cabin in the Sky makes room for the talent it has and kind of carves the stereotypes and the more kind of wince-worthy images out of the way and just sort of makes room for the song and dance, but the right kind of song and dance, And there was only a handful of movies, as I said, that were what some people call black cast movies in the cinema. It started back in 1929 with Hallelujah, King Vidor film, and there was a all-black film called Green Pastures in 1936 that also came from the stage, but Cabin in the Sky in 1943, same year as Stormy Weather, the Bill Bojangles Robinson vehicle, which had the Nicholas Brothers in it. Again, great talent. That film's even kind of more uncomfortable in some ways than Cabin in the Sky. But I think Cabin in the Sky is worth seeing just because you see instantly in the best sequences what Minnelli has learned, 2 year apprenticeship, just to figure out, okay, this is how I'm going to move the camera. The camera does not sit still. It used to sit still and simply record a performer like Astaire or Rogers or, anybody. And then just, just sit still and behave was sort of the camera, attitude of most directors. But Minnelli was really not the first, but the best of sort of the second wave of Hollywood's musical directors to figure out, okay, it's going to stay here, and then it's going to follow this set of dancers, and then it's going to pivot 35, 45 degrees and pick up this line along the curb on the sidewalk. I'm thinking of my favorite minute in the Cabin in the Sky, which is late in the film. It's a nightclub sequence featuring the Duke Ellington Orchestra.
Yeah.
And it's simply, it's called Big Jim's Paradise, I think. Is the name of the club. And it's
Jim Henry's Paradise.
Jim Henry's Paradise. And it's the way Minnelli just sort of simply deals with the dancing chorus of like different couples sort of moving on to the center of the frame and then sort of on an angle sort of into the club. And,
yep.
and you, the camera stays outside for quite a little while because the action is so good.
Mm-hmm.
And every single dancing couple is so differentiated from the previous one. And you're just getting, you sort of just watch it and you're kind of subtly astonished. And then the fifth couple goes in and the doors open and then you're inside and you got, you know, there's Duke Ellington at the piano and then you got a jitterbug number and it's kind of like three fantastic minutes and you can't believe it's the guy's first film.
Yeah.
And he does it all in about three shots. You know, it's like, you know, some shots are really long, some shots are shorter, but I don't know. You just see a certain kind of style that not every director, and in fact, most directors doing musicals in 1943 never learned that kind of camera technique.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy was a natural, and he, you know, his theatrical training was the perfect warm-up for his cinematic debut.
Yeah, that nightclub sequence is where the technical wizardry really comes through. What I was expecting to get from Minnelli, you see touches of it throughout. I'm sure we'll talk about some of them, but that's where it really did stand out for me. And we've heard your thoughts. We've heard some of Josh's before we get to anything I may have to say. Let's actually hear from a listener because we got a really good voicemail that, honestly, I don't have much to say after it. It kind of sums up my overall general thoughts on the film. Nathaniel, he's in South Bend. Very smart listener with some thoughts on Cabin in the Sky.
Hey, Adam and Josh. Nathaniel here from South Bend. I just watched Cabin in the Sky, and I'll be interested to hear your thoughts. For me, on the one hand, it was pretty incredible to see its all-black cast. And apparently this was one of six films shot between 1927 and 1954 to feature all-black performers. I found Ethel Waters' performance to be especially breathtaking. At first, it was almost tender and maternal, and then incredibly wild and sensual in that film's amazing final nightclub scene. On the other hand, yeah, the film is definitely a relic of its time. Coming off of Black Panther only weeks ago, I found Cabin in the Sky fairly cringeworthy in its discernibly white representation of black life and culture, even if it was well-intentioned. Still, I thought the nightclub scene at the end was incredible and clearly indicative of Minnelli's talents. Even the opening tracking shot through the church was pretty thrilling. Finally, I thought one potential critique that could be lodged against this film is that it clearly takes some of its narrative beats and imagery from The Wizard of Oz, but I also wondered if, maybe on the plus side, Cabin in the Sky helped pave the way for something like Powell and Pressburger's A Matter of Life and Death. Anyway, guys, looking forward to hearing your thoughts. And don't forget to remind Michael Phillips while he's there that his opinion of Raiders of the Lost Ark is completely absurd. See ya.
Here we go.
With a rebuttal.
You got a rebuttal, Michael?
Phillips with a rebuttal. You know, I like that voicemail a lot. I thought that was a lot. He had a lot of great insights on Minnelli. And, you know, it's
that he had to ruin it.
You know, at the end there with that Raiders of the Lost Ark thing.
It's going to haunt you.
Yeah. Yep. You're going to regret saying that on the show, Michael. But Nathaniel nails a few things there. He mentions, and this has been touched on, that the movie, as Nathaniel said, is a relic of its time. There are some cringe-worthy moments, but at the same time, there is something incredible. There is something striking about it being this all-black cast. He said one of only six films between 1927 and 54 that did that, 54 being a key year because that was the year the Supreme Court desegregated schools. So this is a rare creature, this
right,
movie, Cabin in the Sky, absolutely. And then Ethel Waters, Josh, you mentioned how great she is.
Well, Louis Armstrong.
And Louis Armstrong, too. And I want to touch on that because you mentioned the talent, and that's such a key part of this. And I do like what Nathaniel said about it taking maybe some narrative energy from Wizard of Oz. But also, I thought about Powell and Pressburger, too. I don't think you can watch this film and not think about A Matter of Life and Death and that dichotomy of the afterlife and the mortal world. And actually, Michael, while you were talking about Minnelli and that dichotomy, I realized that it's maybe not the same type of dichotomy here as what you described in his other films. And yet there is one. It is this battle between these two worlds, between not the home life and the romantic life and the work life in this case, but the home life and romantic life, the sinful life maybe, or the temptations of that life and the virtuous life, right? That's the the dichotomy at play here in Cabin in the Sky.
It's either God-fearing or sin-loving.
Exactly.
You know? It doesn't work out both ways.
I did not know much about this film when I started watching it, other than it was an all-black cast. And you had actually warned us a little bit that maybe this wasn't the best Minnelli film to start with.
Well, it's a risk. It's a risk because some people, you know, rightly so, are really not gonna want to put up with a lot of what this film's trading.
No, and I get that. I think I will say that based on that, the movie struck me as not as blatantly offensive, maybe, as I thought it was going to be. Right. No doubt the general characterization of these characters, it's undeniably and unfortunately in keeping with a classic Hollywood portrayal of African-Americans and their culture. You touched on some of this, but everyone is some combination of churchin', drinking, two-timing, singing, dancing, gambling, smiling. There's a lot of smiling in this movie. It is this kind of Southern folklore. But again, it is this all-black cast, and I think the one thing that did stand out to me is the fact that even if ultimately this movie was made somehow for predominantly white audiences and made by white people, and so maybe they were trying to make those performances and that culture more palatable perhaps for mainstream red white audiences, they aren't standing in comparison to this other culture. There are no white people in the film
it's a completely segregated world.
This way and the white people are this way and this is the better way or the more virtuous way. It's not like that at all. So it feels less, and Josh, you said this, it feels less like exploitation to me and more of a genuine, if misguided, attempt ultimately to celebrate black culture. And that's manifested in a variety of ways, and one of them is these special appearances that pop up in the movie. It's as if Minnelli got together and said, I'm going to showcase the very best of this culture,
this is why in this small southern town suddenly Duke Ellington
shows up, and it is Duke Ellington playing himself.
And he's fantastic.
He is fantastic, but we do get Louis Armstrong playing a character, one of the devil's minions here. We get not only the stars in Eddie Anderson and Ethel Waters, but we get Lena Horne, and we get Bill Bailey doing an incredible tap number in a scene with Ethel and Eddie Anderson at their house where they all three do perform in that. And he kind of just shows up as a friend who otherwise, as I recall, isn't really in the movie. He doesn't have any other lines, but he's there to do this incredible tap dance number.
Yeah, it's a little bit like a vaudeville, like, now we'll have this number.
Exactly.
Right. This is exactly how the Broadway material worked, too, and a lot of Broadway musicals work. They weren't really sophisticated blends of song and story, you know? It was just more like, okay, what can you do?
Yes.
You know?
But can I give you an example where it does work that way? And it's actually my favorite sequence in the film. This is during the nightclub scene, and we have this back and forth between, at this point, Little Joe has left Petunia, okay, and he's moved on with Georgia Brown. Petunia comes into the nightclub
all glammed up,
right?
Yeah.
And here's where story absolutely comes into play, because she goes right up to Georgia Brown and they're giving each other the side eye. And Georgia Brown says, I'm speaking my mind. At one
point,
great line. Petunia returns, and I don't hear a sound. And then she announces, not long after, I suddenly feel a musical urge. And this is – I mean, you talk about representation, okay? Now you have the larger-than-life, full-bodied church woman. You don't see that on screen getting a dance sequence like this.
Right, and she cut and loose.
She puts the slender lady of the night. I mean, Horne's talent is great. This character, I don't think, is as good as
Petunia. She's just a gold digger.
She's just a gold digger.
It's a tired stereotype,
but man,
for sure.
Does this full-bodied church woman put this slender woman of the night to shame on the dance floor.
That's great.
And the fact that Minnelli just lets that play out.
That's Honey in the Honeycomb?
Honey in the Honeycomb, which is a great song.
Amazing moment.
Oh, there's honey in the honeycomb. There's nectar in the peach. There's candy in a coconut shell. And mussels on every beach. Oh, there's money in the savings bank. And I'll personally guarantee, if there's honey in the honeycomb, then baby, look out, 'cause oh, there's love in me.
And Ethel Waters gets to do it with John Bubbles, who was one of the great, and not a name most people know these days, but a wonderful tap dancer and just a real interesting dance stylist, almost as good as Bill Robinson, really. But it's great. You know, you appreciate a movie like this if you like musicals, and especially you have to like a certain kind of folk musical. because it's preserving the talent these people had. And in the case of Waters, it's letting her recreate a stage role. But that minute and a half, and that's all it is. That like, for example, that minute and a half, Honey in the Honeycomb, was the first number that Schickel used in that old documentary back in 73. Huh. And I was like, that's it. I'm in. I'm a Minnelli fan, you know? And I love Ethel Waters, and I love this song. And who wrote this song, you know? And all the questions started.
Yep,
so
I can see that. And I think that probably is, if you're just being really honest and trying to be as objective as possible, the best sequence in the film, without a doubt. And yet, just in terms of a little moment that wowed me, it's in the sequence with Bill Bailey doing the tap dance number, followed by, and Ethel Waters has performed before that, they're at the house, and then we get Eddie Anderson doing this song during Taking a Chance on Love.
And the dance is great.
He starts to dance around the kitchen. Yeah. And at one point, it's like his backside catches on fire, and then he's got to sit in the sink so he can cool off. But the way he moves, and I've never seen Eddie Anderson move before. I've never seen a movie that he's in or any other clips. I don't know what his dance style is, but the way he moves in that frame, there's just a slide that he does, this glide that he does. It almost, like, I had to rewind it to be like, what?
No,
how is
great.
He moving?
It's really interesting.
What is he doing?
Yeah.
And Minnelli with his camera, you're right, Michael, he's moving the camera. It's not as if he's just letting it unfold, but it's not so fussy that it's in any way getting in the way of those dance moves. And he's always filming Anderson in a full body shot, so we're watching those legs and feet move at all times.
Yeah, it's absolutely unique, and it also speaks to characterization, where the performances redeem what could be these stereotypical caricatures, because we have to see how Little Joe, I mean, this all hinges on Petunia genuinely loving Little Joe, right? It's actually her prayers that get him the extra 6 months.
Yeah,
right?
It's
when these two figures hear her, they say, all right, we'll give him another 6 months.
Right.
And so what is that based on? Well, you have to see what she sees in him.
Mm-hmm.
And giving him that dance number, we can understand that. I also think, you know, the title song, Cabin in the Sky, a duet between them, some things about it, you're like, oh, this is, you know, kind of condescending and hokey. But the way they play it, you can see two things, that their character is genuinely in love. And also you see the friction at the heart of this marriage, mm-hmm. and why they have the trouble they do, because her vision of, you know, how life should be is completely at odds with his. And so in this nice number together, you get a sense of their relationship.
You do.
Yeah. When I talked to Desiree Garcia about Cabin in the Sky, she said some things that Nathaniel was right on point with too, I think, that, you know, you have a lot of overlap with The Wizard of Oz, which was filmed just the year or two before Cabin in the Sky on the same studio sets. And you have a similar setup in that you have childlike characters gone wrong. They go to a scary place, but then they find out they belong at home. Now, that works a little easier today if you're watching what is supposed to be a teenage, you know, girl, as opposed to a full-grown adult male, okay? And that's where the condescension and the patronization comes in. There's no question about it. It's hard to watch some of it, but and in fact, they use some of the same tornado footage, just some of the exact same footage.
Yeah.
That
climax.
It's the same, you know, it's MGM repurposing its footage, right? But now some of that, you know, it's those
Toto's dance moves are incredible.
Incredible. Those folkloric trappings are what kind of, you know, Minnelli did the best he could with them. And you can feel, I think you can feel Minnelli being hemmed in by, you know, a story that sort of has this very narrow image of the rural South, and it doesn't really allow the characters much agency, as people say, you know. And even in the movie that came out the same year, Stormy Weather, you have at least some sense of, okay, where did the Great Migration actually allow these people to travel? You know, that's more of a big city up north, you know, musical of, and where the black talent can kind of, you know, grow and develop in some different ways, at least. Cabin in the Sky is really a throwback. Even back in 43, it was a throwback, right? Nonetheless, I think what you learn here is what an intelligent and sensitive director who happened to be white could find a way to bring out, I think, a variety of talent in a variety of ways. And it happened to be all African-American talent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he didn't do anything to try to mess with the, you know, if you want to call it the integrity of the original piece. He didn't try to
He didn't try to push the comedy, which is, I think, crucial to why the film is interesting today. And he didn't want to get in the way of people like Ethel Waters and Lena Horne, mm-hmm. who he had respected for years as a stage director in New York and worked with a lot of them. So, you know, he did a lot. Minnelli did everything to get Lena Horne's image cemented and developed on screen, you know, and it was MGM that dropped the ball on Lena Horne.
Now, credit where credit's due, and you can speak to this more than we can, but according to Wikipedia anyway, we need to give credit for the Shine sequence at the end of this to Busby Berkeley.
Oh, yes.
It says uncredited, but he did direct that or stepped in for some portion
of
that.
Yeah, he did. It might have been, I forget the exact timeline on that, but you know, right from the beginning, Minnelli, as a contract MGM director, would fill in for other people if there was a conflict or just something needed punching up, even in his own movies mm-hmm. when he was well established. You get the film he won his only directing Oscar for, Gigi, much later, 1958. You know, he was off working on the next project, and they didn't, you know, the studio didn't like a couple of scenes, and they sent in, I think it was George Sidney, you know, who was like a solid MGM director, but, you know, kind of a B-level guy to come in and restage some numbers mm-hmm. or shoot some additional footage. I think when it came to restaging stuff he had already shot, that's where Minnelli drew the line.
Yeah.
But, you know, it you come and go. I mean, that's, you know, he dropped out of Kismet for a while, which is a terrible musical and a real stiff. Instructive, I think, too, in the context of this marathon and maybe any marathon, to see the director you're focusing on, to see them really struggle with material and turn in a genuine flop.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, just to watch a musical like Kismet, which really does kind of nail the camera to the floor and just sit there visibly bored, you know, in this horrible CinemaScope frame that Minnelli never really knew how to work with, and a boring musical to boot, Kismet, with exactly one decent song in it. And, you know, Minnelli, you can almost hear him snoring behind the camera. And he couldn't wait to get off the set and let somebody else finish a couple of numbers. Hmm. So, you know, that's how it was at MGM.
So one choice he made in Cabin in the Sky with the moving camera that I do want to note comes really early on.
Yeah.
And, yeah, this scene of a whisper, a bit of gossip that he follows from a face in the front row.
Love that scene.
Who turns to the person behind
and
him.
And we see people singing, popping up.
Yeah, it's a very busy shot, and the camera goes over the congregation and follows the whisper from row to row all the way to the back of the church. And there's an instance where absolutely did not have to do that. It wasn't a musical number. It's really just staging the plot, getting the plot into gear a little bit. But that choice, you know, it does a number of things. It's not only the excitement of the movement, but it also paints the picture of this community.
Mm-hmm.
It makes us realize right away there's not going to be a white face in this thing.
And in a good way, because that scene is not – again, there's not the wrong kind of comedy is not happening in that scene.
No,
you know, it's not like
it's a lightly humorous, you know, observation of small town gossip traveling.
Right, right.
And yeah, it's just a lovely touch early on. You see, wow, first film, first few minutes almost. Mm-hmm. And he's got it going.
I think the other key thing visually that he did get right with Cabin in the Sky is this idea of, okay, how am I going to indicate the presence of the supernatural in this story? So here's little Joe, you know, kind of like half out of his head at death's door, right? And then how are we going to indicate the arrival of, you know, the devil,
mm-hmm.
right? And then so it's very simple solutions. You get this, you know, with the curtains, you get the oil lamp that goes out.
Yep.
And then you get a lighting change, which is completely theatrical, you know, straight out of a Broadway technique. But it works great on screen. And then, you know, these are all very simple kind of building blocks. But you put it all together and it really, you know, it gave the audience the right kind of shiver. And it still works.
Hmm. So I'm overjoyed that we are moving on to Meet Me in St. Louis next week from 1944, because finally, Sam Van Hollegren can't make me feel guilty about it anymore. He adores this film, and I'm finally going to see what all the fuss is about.
Desiree Garcia says this, Cabin in the Sky, a great example of a folk musical of a certain type.
Uh-huh.
Meet Me in St. Louis, the greatest of all folk musicals, period.
Okay.
If you want to look at it that way.
I'm excited, and hopefully all the listeners out there are as well. The Bandwagon, Michael, you mentioned, is the fourth film in the marathon. Some Came Running, you mentioned, is the final film in the marathon. You will definitely be back at least one more time, that Some Came Running show, and maybe when we do our Minnelli Awards as well, we share our best picture, our favorite Minnelli moment. We'll obviously have to pick some kind of great camera move in there as well. So this should be a great marathon. We hope you are going to follow along. You can see the entire lineup just by going to filmspotting.net/marathons or click on marathons right there on the main page. And you're getting this little bonus podcast here a few days ahead of the normal show. We are publishing our traditional film spotting episode on Friday, where we're going to get into, I know, Michael's favorite time of the year, Film Spotting Madness, the 1990s edition. The bracket is back. No Raiders of the Lost Ark to worry about.
All right.
But some good stuff from the 90s that we are going to pair against each other and try to crown one film. One 90s film will reign supreme. And then we're going to get into Annihilation, the new film from Alex Garland, with some bonus spoiler talk there.
Yeah, where we solve the movie. I mean, we nailed it by the end of it.
So, yeah, look forward to that and look forward to the next film in our marathon. Thanks for listening.
Oh, there's honey in the honeycomb, and baby, there's love. Love. Baby, there is love.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.